Hi, everyone. Thank you for listening in. I'm excited for today's session. We're going to be talking with Chase, who is the founder, CEO of a really interesting company called HQO, growth stage tech company in the properties tech space, also an insight partner, SportPro, great friends of ours. And so I'm excited to chat with you, Chase. Thanks for making the time.
Thanks for having me on.
Excited to have you. So Chase, let's just frame it for anyone who's listening. Tell us a little bit of what the business does. How do you think about it?
Yeah, so HQO really is a platform to facilitate commercial real estate experience of the customers and the users of the building, as well as the operations of the building. So, you know, there's a lot of moving components when you think about a complicated office, multifamily, industrial building. There's lots of different personas and stakeholders that both work at the asset, both internally in terms of property management and asset management, externally in terms of vendors, as well as different user types depending on the tenant profile and makeup. A lot of these things for, you know, many, many years in commercial real estate, if anybody listening is familiar, is pretty behind the times from an IT perspective. You know, so many workflows are still even pen and paper. I was in a commercial building in Manhattan the other day, and I had to sign my name in as a visitor, which you would not think would be happening in New York. And so when you think about the amount of time that we spend in, you know, what the geeks in the industry call the built environment, it's a very, very rich physical platform that has a lot of opportunity to facilitate things digitally. And that's what HQO does.
Brilliant. I'm excited to jump into more of what you guys do and the state of the market you work with. But before we do that, let's start with the origin story. You decided to build a business, and it's always interesting to find out what that inflection point was where you decided, I'm going to start a business. I'm going to start this business. So tell us a little bit about the origin story.
Yeah, I mean, the original entrepreneurial origin story for me was probably all the way back in fifth grade when I started my first little venture. So I've always been interested in entrepreneurship. My father was an entrepreneur. My grandfather was an entrepreneur. So I don't think I really had a choice to some degree. And I wasn't necessarily suited for your traditional classroom. So I always kind of enjoyed things outside the system. My co-founders and I have been working together for almost 20 years. Yeah, we previously started a digital media business and ad tech business that we sold to a very big media conglomerate called Advance Publications. Mm-hmm. So if you're familiar with Condé Nast, Vanity Fair, they own a big portion of Reddit. So we sold that business in 2012 after, you know, as we get into HQO, I'll describe some of the parallels, but a lot of what was happening to traditional advertising was being disrupted by Google and Facebook and all that stuff at the time. So we were trying to help traditional media companies make the transition to digital. While we were there, we reported into their B2B media division, and they did a lot of work in commercial real estate. And so we became interested in the category, but we did not immediately move into the space. So when we left after, we didn't make it quite the full earnout period, but we made it a good portion, I would say 3 out of 4 years. we left in 2016-17. We went back to our original investors in the first business. So we worked with, it was a venture firm that was called Atlas that became Accomplice. So anybody who's familiar with their Boston-based firm that does seed and series A, they did DraftKings, they did Hopper, they've done a number of big wins in crypto. So they were kind of a generalist fund. We had a great run with them on the first business. They really funded my co-founder and I out of college. So they kind of helped us get our legs under us, if you will, on our first go round, and then wrote us a check for the second venture, which we had some loose ideas. And ultimately, we landed on HQO after pivoting our first concept that looked really good on paper. We got to about $1 million of ARR in 8 months. And I had to go to the guys. And
which back then, right now in this AI world, sounds slow, but back then that was rapid.
Yeah, that was in 2016-17. So it was very fast.
Flying then.
Yeah, and that was like 8 months from like quitting our jobs. So it was quick, but I had to go to them and be like, this is a leaky bucket. It's not a good business model. So we can give you the money back or we can pivot. And they're like, nah, go figure something else out. So we've had a very good run with them over a couple of different ventures. And so where we netted out and how we ultimately landed on HQO was for people who remember in 2017, WeWork had just achieved their $65 billion valuation from SoftBank. And, you know, we had kind of gone on a tour of like everybody I knew. I went to the founders of HubSpot. I talked to Brian Halligan and some people and showed them what we had built. And I said, look, we've built some interesting software. The use case isn't great. What do you think? And on that tour, spoke to David Cancel at Drift, spoke to all these folks because we're kind of in desperation mode. And then, well, I wouldn't say kind of. We're in desperation, yeah. Right? We're trying to find a new business model. And I ended up going down to WeWork HQ, and it was the height of madness. So it's like 1 p.m. on a Tuesday, and I thought I was at like an EDM concert. Yeah. Kind of like looking around, like, what the hell's going on here? And I was supposed to be meeting with their head of product, and the guy blew me off for the meeting. And so I'm sitting there, you know, like, ah, shit, what are we going to do? And this young woman came out, and she's like, hey, are you Chase? I said, yeah. She's like, I looked at your product, and you guys should go into commercial real estate. I was like, well, that's what I'm here to see if there's a partnership. She's like, oh, you don't want to work with us. Yeah. And I was like, huh? And she's like, yeah, we got a lot of problems. And shortly after that, the air started coming out of the balloon on WeWork, but it set us on our path. So we quickly pivoted at the end of 2017 and went to the guys at Accomplice and said, you know, hey, we've been interested in commercial real estate since we sold the last business. Like light dawns on Marblehead. What you're looking at with WeWork is they're aggregating the consumer experience and they're disconnecting the asset owner from the demand side, which anybody who's read like Ben Thompson's blog on aggregation theory knows that this was it's a pretty prevalent business model. If you look at Airbnb, you look at Uber, they aggregated the demand side and then they commoditized the supply. But we were like, but they're doing it in a really capital intensive way. It's not a technology company. It's a real estate services business. It's acting much more like a hotel. And so we said, we think there's a real opportunity to essentially create the digital interface to the asset. So all these things that you do in what is a very, very, you know, rich physical platform environment of, you know, your key card, engaging with the retail on the ground floor, engaging with the amenities at a building, doing visitor management, submitting tickets for issues at the building, et cetera, parking, like all these things that touch the physical platform that's commercial real estate. We're like, how come this isn't facilitated through software? So that's where we were. We were off to the races and they said, look, you're running out of money. We had probably about 8 weeks of cash. If you can...
Wow, so you got this insight like 8 weeks before you guys ran out of money.
Yeah, we were dead in the water. And wow. They said, if you can, you know, get some commit, you know, we'll bridge you. And we signed really quickly. We built a mobile app in like 2 to 4 weeks. And we signed three landlords and Accomplice, who I can't speak highly enough about, bridged us. And we ended up bringing on a number of prop tech focused funds, which I didn't even know existed, right? So we get into this world of commercial real estate. Anyone who's been in tech and startups knows a ton of brokers because they're constantly calling on you. So talk to a bunch of brokers. They put us in touch with all these people. JLL ended up coming into the round. Big real estate groups ended up coming into the round. So we went from, you know, end of 17, we're dead, to halfway through 2018, we're a whole new business called HQO, which we came up with, it stood for Headquarters Optimized. So
I like the HQ.
Yeah.
That's a great story. I there's so many places to go with it, but the one I've been thinking about is your family, actually. So you come from a family of entrepreneurs, and usually what you find is when there's a couple of generations of people that like to build things, then that becomes part of the DNA. What do you think causes that? Like, can you think back to why you were such? Like, why you were so focused on building something? Was it just like you saw what they did and you saw different generations building businesses, how much they enjoyed doing so? The fulfillment, I guess, that you get from it, because not every day is enjoyable. Is that what causes it? Or what are your thoughts on that?
That's a great question, because I've thought a lot about this, because my father and I are very different entrepreneurs. He is a healthcare services guy. He's excellent at, he's gone from zero to one a couple of times. And he's done it across very different businesses. He did a furniture business. He's done healthcare services, but then he did a number of businesses where he essentially partnered with an entrepreneur and went from one to 10, 10 to 100. And so, you know, where I got kind of the interest on, I would say, the business side of entrepreneurship was when I was very young. He would just bring me along to things. And I think his grandfather was your much more typical, you know, first generation small business entrepreneur, came over from Italy and ran, you know, different forms of businesses. And where I got my technical side was from my mother's grandfather. He was an engineer, that we learned basically 2 years before he died for, what ended up being CIA, where he built the satellite imagery technology that spied on the Soviets during the Cold War.
Wow.
Yeah. And it was declassified, which was very cool. And it kept us out of nuclear war, which was, which, you know, being that generation, the greatest generation, he never talked about it. And one day he's on CNN and we're all like, huh,
what did you do?
So I think the technical side of being interested in how things can be built very differently, I get from my maternal grandfather. And then in terms of the business, that is very much kind of family. It's been bred into me. My father just brought me along. I worked for his businesses growing up in different forms. Still the worst job. I did janitorial stuff and all that, which I didn't mind at all at his company. When he put me in ARAP, where I had to file the physical papers.
That's when you got upset.
Oh my God, I almost, that almost made me quit. So he made me do all the different things, which was great. Whereas he gave my sister a corner office from day one, which I thought was total bullshit. But we've had kind of both sides, and he had it too, where he just, it was kind of part of his nature. I think part for me was, I never liked the, I don't know, I've always had a little bit of the, like, you know, fuck the traditional system kind of thing. I don't know if that's nature or nurture, probably a little bit of both.
A little bit of both, I tend to think. Because, like, you said something about school. I was similar. I was a horrible student. I was kicked out of more schools than my parents like to remember. But there's something that, I don't know, I think part of that is nature, and then part of that is probably the environment you're growing up in and the rub that has on you. Like, I remember growing up in Pakistan, it was a war zone. I was like, what am I studying for? Like, this is not what's going to be useful here. And so it's a combination. You've had this really interesting background. You built this business out. 2018, things start working now, right? Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And do you remember, I think about this thing a lot, which is finding product market fit. And till you have found it once, you probably don't even know what you're looking for.
Mm-hmm.
But once you've had it, you know that there's this market pull that you can get. And you're like, okay, shit, we're on to something.
Yep.
Did you, because you had felt that in your first business, did you feel that building the second business out, getting to product market fit, trying to scale it out, there were certain potholes you were able to navigate past, even though these businesses were in very different areas? Was there a significant advantage you felt of being a second-time founder?
Yeah, for sure. Where, and I think there's both advantages and disadvantages in the second-time thing that I can talk about, which is, you know, there's some patterns that I think a lot of people run into. But I think one of the things when you think about product market fit, is certainly one of the advantages, in the sense that you really know when you don't have it. And I think on the first, oftentimes entrepreneurs get started because they're passionate about something. And I think one of the most critical skills that anybody who's starting something has to have is you have to have this weird personality trait of two extremes where you both can be very objective about your baby. Yeah. Because you have to be, you have to recognize its warts and its problems. Yeah. And you have to be able to iterate and evolve to make it work. And then there are times where 99 out of 100 people might tell you why it's a bad idea. And you have to be like,
you have to have belief.
Yeah.
It's such a hard needle to thread. Because it's like, these are two polar opposites. You have to like believe blindly, but at the same time, objectively look at this thing.
And I think that's where the second time, the advantage is how you parse signal from noise. And so I think on my first go round, you know, when we started, we were between the ages of like 21 and 24 when we were really getting that business off the ground. And you run into some people, and I'm sure you know this from starting the business, like you look back and being like, man, at the time, that person seemed like a really big deal, make or break. Like, you know, I got some crippling feedback on the first business from somebody who, you know, 15 years later, I was like, oh, shit, that guy had no clue what he was talking
about. I cared about that person's opinion, really.
Yeah, totally. Yeah. And then there was some subtle advice that I got where I was like, oh, man, that person was really onto something. But they were like,
I totally missed it.
And didn't hit me over the head with it. And I was like, shit, I wish I had listened to that guy. You know, so I think you get better at parsing, you know, the signal and where you start to implement.
You probably also had some belief that I've done something. I've built it and sold it. Like, I got this. Like, there's this little bit of belief. Whereas when you're a first-time founder, I found that you can have this, like, am I good enough for this? Like, can I do this? Like,
yeah, your imposter syndrome. And I think, by the way, I think that's when I said there's some disadvantages to second-time founders. I think some level of imposter syndrome is a very healthy thing. Mm-hmm. Too much of it is a very bad thing.
Yeah.
Right? Because when you think about it, like, hey, I don't have the background to be here. Well, none of the greats had the background to be there, but you see it. I mean, like, Steve Jobs is the most famous example of this where, you know, his imposter syndrome was gone on his second go round and Next, and those things really didn't work. He talked about that very famously, right? So,
and he came back very different. Like, he came back as a different person the second time around, and even how he operated the business, like, it's really interesting when a founder realizes what's the absolute best way to operate my business. And Apple was a design first business. And so he would sit in the middle of design. And the process of design was very, very interesting, where it was basically a lot of product people just constantly pitching him. He would poke holes in it using his taste. Like, he trusted his taste a lot more the second time around. It was this like constant iteration to get to great. And he would have these really interesting nuanced perspectives. Like, once they were building this computer, which was supposed to be a square, and they built it as like a perfect square, and he looked at it and he's like, no human being is perfect, so when you look at perfect things, you don't connect with them, so let's add a little bit of, let's cut the dimensions a bit. You might not even catch it with your eye, but he believed your soul would catch it. Like, that type of stuff started coming into the mix, which is really interesting.
Yeah. And he like became very, his process, I remember he would have them write on note cards, but he wouldn't allow names because he didn't want people just gravitating towards his ideas and all these things. He infused the right ways, I think, to unlock talent. I mean, he always balanced the, and I think one of the other things that, you know, gets retold to people outside of, you know, a company in an industry like that, I think it's hard for people to understand when you hear the stories of how like ruthlessly hard he was on people. But if you want to be great, and you hear the people who were great at Apple, Johnny Ive, whoever it is,
they wouldn't leave.
They appreciate that, right?
Well, absolutely.
So, like, and I say this to people we work with, which is, it's not a right or wrong thing. It's just a stylistic thing of like, some of my best friends in the world would not want to work in an environment where, you know, we're trying to do something that inherently the odds are very low, right?
Yeah.
That's what technology startups are from the get-go.
I think greatness generally requires this tolerance for friction and tolerance for, and almost this appreciation and love for straight feedback. Like, you don't have time to package it. You know, that essential model of give feedback as a sandwich, good thing, bad thing. It's like, no, we don't have time for this. It's like the straight feedback. That I find that people that have played team sports, this is one thing that if you can find really intelligent people that have played team sports, you're working with a couple that are such, they have this in them where you don't have to package the feedback. They want it as raw as possible and they kind of yearn for it, which is really nice to see.
Yeah, if you can, and I think people like that inherently dislike politics. So like, sure. I think part of the problem where you see why is it, and you listen to whether it's the Sequoia folks, the Insight Platform folks, Andreessen Horowitz, whoever, the people who've seen the patterns of great companies, you know, continually point to, I mean, Jobs talked about this himself, which is why is there such a high failure rate of people who come out of large organizations that are incredibly successful at those successful companies into these types of organizations? And I think the skill set required with regards to, you know, diplomacy and politics and all that, it's just a different skill set than, you know, you think about straight line work, right? What's the fastest path to value?
Which, the flattest old we can have was right. And how can we move energy through this system as efficiently as possible?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And so when you get that, it's, you know, again, it's not right or wrong. Like the world has all different types of organizations, but it's not really negotiable from what I've seen. Maybe somebody else has figured out how to do it differently, but it's not really negotiable in our world. You have to kind of give it to me straight. Give me as much raw data as I can get. Not only do I not care about how you're packaging it, so long as the intent is good. I do believe in good human intent, but
I'm not sure if
you are packaging it, then I don't know if I can trust that as much. You know what I mean?
Yeah, that's positioning. Like, yeah. Positioning something. I was thinking about the emails I send now. And like when I was younger, when I was starting off, my emails would be, I hope you're having a nice day. And you would like, and now these emails are like two lines and it's very flat. It's like straight. And you know, you realize that you don't need all this other crap. You just need those two lines. That's what's required.
And you also, when you first get those, when you're first coming out, you're like, oh man, it's this person.
Did I do something wrong? Like, does this person not like me? What did I do?
Yeah.
And now you're like, oh, that's just the way everyone should talk. So you've got this taste in terms of company building, the experience that has given you a toolkit to be able to think through the type of company you want to build and take it through its various inflection points. There's this theme that I've been thinking about a lot, which is that volatility has now become our steady state. So the thesis is that traditionally in 10-year periods, you would have 8 or 9 years of stability and then a year or so of volatility. And the playbook for volatility that all of our elders give us is kind of based on that, right? You extend runway, cut costs, kind of hunker down, and then you worry about growth once the worst is behind us. But if you think back to the last 5 years, you had COVID, you had ZIRP, then inflation and interest rates went up, so the market was all over the place until 2024, halfway into 2024, it was pretty choppy. You had a minute of stability and now we have what we have. And a lot of the conversation that's happening right now is around how, if this is the steady state, if volatility stays at higher than usual levels, then we all have to learn how to come to terms with it and operate our businesses within it. Curious about that 5-year stretch, because you sell into a market where interest rates matter a lot. They matter for all of us, we learned, but they matter a lot for real estate. What was the experience going into 2020, COVID hits, then the market booms? Tell us a little bit about those few years.
Yeah, I mean, as my father would say, sometimes it's better to be lucky than good. And we closed our Series B financing with Insight was December of 2019. And so we're right at that up ramp, right? We go from 2018, completely new business. And we ended 2018 with, I don't know, 200K of ARR. And then we end 2019 just shy of 3 million of ARR. So when we talk about product market fit, we got it. And all the landlords are pushing back on WeWork. Everyone has a really great occupancy and interest rates are low. The edge is all, you know, in order to get alpha as an investor, you need any edge you can get. And it's like digital. Every real estate group had hired innovation, tech people, all the stuff. Money was good. And then 2020 hits, and our first board meeting, April of 2020, we're on Zoom, which Zoom board meetings were not really a thing.
Not as stylish as they are now.
Yeah, right. That really wasn't a thing. In fact, everybody took the in-person dinner before the meeting seriously, all this stuff. And I just remember the look on the people. You know, our guys at Insight are great, but they're kind of like, well, we didn't have this in our scenario plan, but what do you think? And it was still to the point where, you know, it was like, well, I don't know, the, you know, Trump and everybody else is saying 2 weeks to crush the curve. So I don't know, 2 weeks.
Sounds good.
And it's like a month, 2 months. And we had what I would say through 2020 and 21, it felt like every month was a year, because 1 month it was, we sold hard on the comeback, right? Like, you got to greet people back in the buildings, a new way, blah, blah, blah. 21 was brutal because Mark Zuckerberg and Mark Benioff are spouting to the world that remote is the future. They're both in Hawaii talking about how great it is to be remote. And Zuckerberg saying we're all going to have headsets and digital avatars and, you know, we're never going to go to concerts or work again. So that was pretty brutal. Yeah. And we had to, you know, it's one of these things too, when it's like, when do you iterate, not pivot, but when do you iterate? And how do you think about that? And we tried a lot of different things on the edges, but we fundamentally never left our original competitive set. A bunch of them went into online collaboration and away from the built environment.
Interesting. Yeah.
And we kind of stuck to our guns, saying like, we don't really know what work and these things are going to look like, but we fundamentally believe that we're not going to have like abandoned cities. And so we stuck with commercial real estate, which
is a really hard bet to have made in that moment. Like, I think about your experience of company building. There's a founder that you might know. Do you know AJ Bruno? Quarterpath. They released a Series B from Insight a little bit after you did. Him and I do a podcast together. And it's really interesting contrasting your experiences, because 2020, like that first moment where everything froze, was kind of similar for all of us, right? We business just got frozen. Yeah. But then for them, they were selling sales commission software. It's up and to the right from there on, right? For you guys, it's a very different experience.
Polar opposite.
At that point, everyone felt the world has changed forever. Now, in hindsight, you end up looking much more right than the others, right? Where everybody wants to be back in offices. And there's this push of now there's startups in office 7 days a week, 12 hours a day, right? Yeah. So there's been a bit of a shift, but it was very hard to have that view at that point.
Yeah. And look, we had the benefit of when we had kind of gone into the space. And it's interesting because when you look at our first business, you look at the kind of first version before we pivoted to HQO, it looks like wildly different things, but we actually believe we've been solving the same underlying problem for 20 years, where our first business, we would create these digital platforms for cities because we believe very, very deeply that innovation clusters. You see this, you know, throughout human history, in terms of, you know, name any great civilization, and there's a clustering of people in some sort of city that defined it. Whether you want to call it Athens, Rome, you want to go into London. You know, London with in Birmingham with the Industrial Revolution, Detroit with the Auto Revolution, media, finance, fashion in New York, internet, Silicon Valley, life sciences, things like that. You know, Cambridge, Boston. This happens, right? Like, so the most economic progress tends to be clustered. And there are all these great books, Triumph of the City, which is written by a Harvard professor. But even before that, there's this woman, Jane Jacobs, in the 50s and 60s, completely uncredentialed, which I love, who wrote these kind of like pivotal books of, you know, the economy of nations and cities. And she has some of the earliest works of this combination of how there is no such thing as a national economy. There's a national economy is just a network of city economies because people cluster to produce economic progress. And she then wrote about how do you design cities to make the most of that. So we've always been relatively fascinated with kind of this platform that is the city for economic progress. And there's all sorts of research behind why it is that, you know, this clustering ultimately drives us forward. And so we had that to fall back on. And as my wife likes to say, like, if you want to put people to sleep, talk about that research. But
I studied public policy in university, so I'm very fascinated right now. Yeah. I can see why she says that.
It's a niche thing.
She's
also a communications professional, so she's very much, and she works in consumer goods, so she's all about mass, you know, communication. it's a little bit more wonkish, which I realize, but it is.
This is where conviction comes from. It's like a unique insight and informed by something you have consumed and developed a point of view around. And I find that when you go back to great companies, there's this strength of character they need to have in certain moments. And if it is informed from reading, listening, learning, like developing a real view versus chasing a trend, right? Like I know a lot of founders, and I've been in groups with a lot of them, where they're just chasing the trend. It's like, this is how I can make some money right now. And that's fine. Sometimes it works. Like sometimes you catch a trend at the right time and the market's good and you can make a ton of money that way. But generational defining businesses, resilient businesses, they require like a backbone. And that comes from something like this, some niche reading.
Yeah, that's absolutely right. And it, you know, it kind of ties into, you know, what we're talking about with regards to excellence, but, and you mentioned sports teams, like you never get better. You know, I played basketball in college. I didn't get better playing, you know, with the same level of talent. Yeah. And I got better when I practiced, you know, by myself, but at the same time, if I only practiced by myself and I didn't go out and get my ass kicked, you know, in AU by a better team, things like that, I wouldn't have gotten better. I certainly wouldn't have gotten better if I didn't watch the guys ahead of me play. So when you think about just like when you tie it back to the first principles of work, are we really going to build world-class organizations, industries, you know, things like that, if everyone is isolated at home? No. Are you going to have significantly more flexibility, customization, forms of work, things like that because of digital tooling that we've seen in every other industry? Yeah absolutely. Okay. But are we going to have, like, are cities going to be ghost towns? No, because inherently, people being around people has a ton of value. And so we believe that deeply. And so we kind of stuck with it and we did a bunch of short-term things to keep the lights on, right? Because we, you know, you do what you have to do. And there was probably what I would say was kind of 2020 through 2023, two, three, four years of kind of the fog of war of, like, you know, it definitely tests your conviction of when, you know, you're going on.
So I'm right.
The third COVID shot of now it's returning and people still aren't returning. And we didn't want it to come to it, but we did say, like, you know, once interest, you know, money was free. And if you've been around startups and you guys see a ton of startups, you see this excess. And like we've been through cycles, .com, great financial crisis. We cut our first, you know, we started our first business 2005 and six. So we went through 07, 08, 09. And, you know, it's like, yeah.
Well, that's interesting because for your age, you're one of the rare founders who had experienced a previous downturn.
Yeah. And we tried a capital raise in 08, 09, and it was just, you know, and
who's the easy part?
So we kind of saw, like, this is a time of great excess. And it was, you know, we were like, you know, I think it's going to take some pain to get people back, right? Like, and sure, the pain has come and we've seen the layoffs and everything that's happened. So to kind of tie it all the way back, though, to your point about, you know, volatility, we certainly didn't seek it out. But what's been interesting was, you know, in 2020 and 2021, you know, we went from, you show up to the board meeting, we have a bunch of different VCs. And they're all being really nice to us because, like, oh, these poor guys are in, like, the one area where every other business is booming up and to the right because you could sell anything that was, you know, SaaS-based to anybody at that time. And we're grinding it out and, like, nobody wanted to be in office software. And then it went into 2022 where, you know, tech lost $7 trillion in the public markets and like the air started coming out of the balloon. And, you know, they kind of looked at us and it still wasn't better for commercial real estate by any means, but they were like,
now everyone was the same.
Yeah, and one of them said to us, they were like, well, you guys have been getting the shit kicked out of you for a while, so you'll be fine. So, and I was like, well, if we can do anything, we can take a fucking beating. So, and I like our odds if it comes down to that. So, you know, 20.
How did all of this, because you've gone through this entire experience, and now where we're sitting today, as we mentioned a few seconds ago, people are talking about offices in a way where that's the way you build a great business. You hear Lemkin talk about this a lot in San Fran. He's like, there's no chance if you're not in office, it's 7 days a week, because there are people that are probably competing against you that are doing that. And so you've seen this huge shift. Like, so I don't think we're running a remote exec search, probably one or two right now as an overall business. How did all of this inform your, because the world has changed though, right? Like how we work in offices has changed a little bit, how we mm-hmm. think about spreading our teams out, et cetera. There's a lot more companies with teams in LATAM that they're leveraging and getting value out of. How has all of this informed your product strategy? What's different now compared to where you were going before?
I think what was nice for us was, and you know, we didn't know it would happen this way, but we actually believed this was kind of the underlying hypothesis in 2018 and 19, which was, you know, WeWork was proving that at the time, and this is, you know, even before AI, you know, when you looked at the average tenure of a Fortune 500 company in, you know, the back half of the 1900s, it's a 75-year average tenure. You get big and you're stable, right? You get pension and, you know, the term company man comes from that, right? So, and then you look, we get into, you know, the 21st century and it's gone down to something like 17 years. And now today, I think it's even getting faster. Look, NVIDIA comes out of nowhere, right? And they're at the top of the heap, depending on the week. And we believed that when business cycles move that fast, your human capital planning cannot work such that you can take a 25, 30-year lease in these different markets. And if you just look at, you know, when you think of the underlying infrastructure of society, people travel more, they move more, right? Like talent can move more, right? So, you know, we both believed that there is talent density and network effects to these great ecosystems, but at the same time, the businesses, you know, the formation and how fast business moves goes so quickly that the underlying business, whether it's a warehouse or an office building or a lab or whatever form of commercial real estate it is, they just were not set up to fundamentally cater to the new way of work. And so that was before COVID. Then during COVID, we're trying to figure out, you know, is this going to be, you know, are we dealing with like hybrid and remote like features that somehow plug into this? And luckily, it's just come back to, you know, if at the end of the day, you know, with knowledge work, and because we have people in different time zones, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5 is an antiquated concept created by Henry Ford on the assembly line. It made total sense when everybody had on the assembly line at that time. But, you know, we're basically back to work happens dynamically all over more, but the clustering of talent is still, and you know, maybe more important than ever. So, you know, it kind of fit into our original thesis.
Brilliant. And so now you've got this one new element that I want to click into, which is, you know, we talked about headwinds and tailwinds. 2023 was this ChatGPT moment that came out. And that's informed so much of everything since, right? Like it's probably the overarching theme right now for most businesses, whether it's building an AI company, whether it's integrating it into an existing organization, whether it's trying to implement it in the business operationally. This is what is top of mind for everyone. Tell us a little bit about your view on AI as it stands today and how you see it evolving, but specifically how it will play into the mission that you guys have, what you guys are doing, what you guys are building, what type of opportunities or risks does it create for you guys?
Yeah. So I think in our category, it's really interesting. So even for people who don't really know commercial real estate that well, I think everybody is somewhat familiar with, you know, the general buzziness around the concept of a smart building in a smart city. So anyone around technology, you know, has heard those terms. And, you know, when you get closer to our industry where the people who actually are, you know, doing the atoms, not the bits in the physical world, they've been sold for 30. I mean, this goes back to the 90s, kind of this, like, we're going to be building smart buildings and smart cities. You know, it's been talked about for so long that a lot of people had gone numb to it. Now, there's different progress in different areas. You look at, like,
Peter Thiel talks about this a lot, like how the innovation stopped in the atoms and went into the bits because we created so much regulation and trash that slowed everything down. People just got nauseated and changed their attention.
Yeah, and he's absolutely right. What's sad in that, particularly our category, when you look at where some great innovators are going to do things, you know, a ton of things are happening in Dubai and Saudi Arabia and all these things where, you know, you have a group of people over there who can just cut through red tape and be like, we're doing it, right? Yeah. And so you have some great entrepreneurs here who have to, like, leave the country to do some great things. And so that's a whole other thread in terms of what needs to happen here to unlock some of, you know, I think the benefits that our society needs. But, you know, we operate in 24 different countries, so it is what it is. But, you know, with regards to AI, the way I view it in our category is they're compared to regular SaaS and these things, a lot of those products are very good. A lot of those industries were comfortably on their way to, you know, digital adoption and all the digital transformation stuff that McKinsey and everybody was selling for 20 years to these companies. And, you know, our category just missed it. And when you start to, I think the lazy answer that a lot of people in commercial real estate and investors in the category and things say is, like, you know, these people are not tech oriented. And I couldn't disagree with that more. When you think about the technology that real estate developers are dealing with, they're incredibly technical. I mean, the people who invented the elevator changed history, right? Like, you know, the guy's name was Otis. And when you look at modern day skylines and all this, wouldn't have happened without the elevator. When you look at,
no one's climbing 85 stairs.
Yeah, right. So, you know, there's different forms of technology that happen with regards to the different building management systems. Even you think about the energy grid and all of this stuff, like, it's very technical people, but it's, when you think about the SLA, I mean, it's got to work all the time. And then connecting, you know, bits to atoms is a whole different ballgame than, you know, just say digital CRM or whatever it is. So with regards to AI and the promise of the category, I think all of us that entered into it were early. And now that we have these, when you think about pulling apart kind of the, you know, the broad term of AI with regards to, you know, machine learning, natural language processing, you know, predictive analytics, the things required to truly automate one workflow in a building are now available. And if you can automate one workflow, and then you can automate all of the other workflows in one building, then you have a smart building. And if you can stack a bunch of smart buildings, and if you can stack that with other key pieces of infrastructure in a city, that's what a smart city actually is, where it's automated in order to create...
Oh, that's very interesting.
Yeah, a better experience and a more efficient, you know, civil society. So all of this was kind of the buildup to get to this moment. And so I think, like, frankly, the starting gun was just shot on the whole...
That's right. That's great. That's fantastic. It sounds like the business is at a really interesting point in time. Like, everything is trying to set it up for this moment. But as we close this up, you know, the thing I've been thinking about through this is to have gotten through what you guys went through, as well as to actualize the vision that you've got, you've got to build a business that has some key principles that inform the culture or the environment of that business. Tell us a little bit about that. What are like the top 2, 3, 4 core principles that you think have helped this organization get through where it has gotten through and also will help it achieve this grander vision that you have that seems possible now with AI?
Yeah. So, I mean, I think it's taken us a while to articulate it, but when we think about kind of our mission and core purpose, you know, we've used different language, but when you think about like, and if you've ever been in a city, I got to witness it in Boston in one particular neighborhood that it was the Seaport District that before the Big Dig, where, you know, we took a bridge and a highway and we put it underground and we completely opened up the city of Boston. It was just a set of parking lots. And now if you come to Boston, it's probably the most hustling. It's like a new city within the city.
Yeah.
Right?
I've heard
plenty of examples of this in other cities, but it's kind of our big one. And when it works, you kind of catch magic, and it happened there in terms of they got the, you know, hungry entrepreneurs to go and work in these like shitty buildings, and then capital started coming in, service providers started coming in, developers came in. It's like a, you know, it's a beautiful new mini city. So we've kind of believed in like, how do you facilitate that in a lot of ways? And from a mission, we essentially call that the quantum city. And so we're trying to build the platform to unlock, you know, quantum cities much more programmatically, because we believe that economic progress is, you know, the best thing that you can help do for humanity. So we've kind of gotten our mission pretty nailed down over, you know, a couple of decades here. But I would say in terms of the people and how we operate the business, one of the things that we screwed up on the first business compared to the second business was we got very lucky on the first business. The first three hires we made, and we're, you know, 20 something, happened to be good. So as a, you know, 24, 25 year old CEO, I was like, oh, hiring people's easy.
Yeah.
I mean, it's not. And so we heard a bunch of people after that, you know, we kept waking up being like, why is this so hard? And it wasn't those people's fault. It was our fault, because, you know, we basically were like, you want to work here? Sure. You know. So one of the things that we did on the second business was, you know, we had a very good group of people that we brought along, and we said, just describe the attributes of one another that make you all good to work with. And so our initial kind of company values were authentic. They weren't bullshit, right? Like the, you know, the Enron example of how they have the poster in the kitchen of integrity and all this, right? So ours, we ended up, you know, it fit neatly into, we are a Boston company, and we were at the height of the Tom Brady era, and it fit into the Let's Go acronym, which was kind of his thing. And, you know, it was learning, excellence, truth, service, goodness, and ownership. And, you know, we've really honed those in terms of the people who succeed with us are infinite learners. They really are self-taught and are like, you know, insatiably curious. From an excellence perspective, it's these people that, you know, they think the same way, you know, a guy like Brady does in terms of like 1% better every day.
Yeah.
This is not the output, it's the input. Like, are you doing the little things that compound over time? And do you need to be pressed to do that? Or are you just somebody that naturally is like trying to, who's the best at this thing that I'm doing, and how do I learn from that? And, you know, you have discipline day in, day out, stick with that. Truth, we just don't believe in bullshit. We give it to people straight, and, you know, ultimately feedback is a gift. And truth also comes in data, right? So bring it in data, and we don't have to argue about it. Service is all about customer, right? Like, that's why we're in the business. Do we have people who inherently love our customers, which in commercial real estate is a very unique business? So you have to be deeply interested in kind of the vertical.
It's probably the most interesting asset class and community of business builders in the world. I've been helping this media company build out. It came out of the real deal, and this guy who ran content for them is building it out, called Promote. And I'm helping him, and so I'm learning about the characters. And this is like every day you learn about these are some of the most interesting business people you will find in the world sit in CRE.
Oh yeah. I mean, it's the pro sports owners. I mean, the term landlord literally comes from feudalism, right?
Yeah.
So it's an interesting category. And like, there's a little bit of a sickness in terms of like, yeah, I want to go get my teeth kicked in by people who love negotiating, right? It's kind
and
of
live
like,
life leverage the way some of these guys live life, right? Like this is life on the edge.
Oh yeah, like the biggest mavericks. And what's funny is anyone who has success in any industry, then when they make money, somehow gets into commercial real estate. Yeah. So it's like you get people from everywhere that have found success. So that's a critical part of it. And then, you know, the last two, goodness is just about being a good teammate. Like life's too short to work with people that aren't good teammates. And ownership. We're big fans of kind of the book Extreme Ownership. And we just, it goes both ways too. It's not, you know, just take ownership when you make a mistake or something like that. But we want people to come in and say, I want to move up. I want to take on a hard thing. I want to do, you know, this and that with my career. I want to be an entrepreneur, whatever. I want to start a business one day. So we like people that, you know, take ownership of their area. And those things have kind of been the guiding principles, you know, frankly, from Venture App, which was the first version before it became HQO to today. So I think that's what, when you tie it all back to how have we made it through the volatility, a lot of those characteristics and traits, I think, are what's required for people that can just kind of survive in this new world.
And it feels like those are the same characteristics and traits that will help them capitalize on the upside available with AI as well, which is, I guess, you know, when I first started, I used to find values and culture and these things a little bit wishy-washy. Because as a recruiter, I would go into companies and ask them, tell me about your culture. And they tell you about the table tennis table and the food they give. And you're like, okay, nobody knows what it is. This probably doesn't exist. Now I've realized it's probably the most important thing. But then you find that this, the best principles you hear of are the ones that will help in the down in volatility and help capitalize on the upside. And this feels like the backbone of the organization. Jeez, I've had a lot of fun talking to you. This has been great. Congratulations on building a really great business. And I, as I'm reflecting on this conversation, there are a lot of people I talk to that are riding momentum, and there are very few people I talk to that have a real point of view on what they're trying to do and why that's the way to do it. Those are the best conversations. So I appreciate your time and good luck.
Thank you, Asad. Thanks for having me.